Coming up, I got 7 questions about the NBA playoffs, draft, and upcoming offseason. We're going to get to that. And then later, I got an interview with Duke prospect Con Knipl. Super impressive kid. Hope you enjoy that interview, especially if you're a team hoping to draft him. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We get a good one today, going through 7 questions about the playoffs, the draft, and trade rumors. And let's start out with the Eastern Conference playoffs. We didn't talk about that with my episode with Dane Moore covering the West on Sunday night. So let's talk about the East here. Question number 1, how long until we see Aaron Nesmith defend Jalen Brunson? To me, this is one of the keys of the entire series here, because last playoffs in the second round between the Pacers and the Knicks, Andrew Nembhard was the guy who started that series off defending Brunson. Brunson went off for 43 points in game 1, 29 points in game 2. Knicks went up 2-0 in that series, and then the Pacers made a change. Aaron Nesmith got put on Brunson, and then Nembhard went on Dante DiVincenzo. Of course, DiVincenzo is now in Minnesota, not in New York anymore. But this time around, I wonder, are we going to see Nesmith against Brunson? Because the results were great last year for the Pacers. Against Nesmith, Brunson shot only 25 of 65, 38.5%. And then against Nembhard, he shot 25 for 37, 67.6%. So for Indiana, if you're trying to contain Jalen Brunson, the results last postseason were in favor of Nesmith over Nembhard. Will the Pacers start the series this way? We'll see. We'll find out Tuesday night, game 1. And if they do, are they going to switch to it at some point? Because, you know, the challenge is that the Knicks are bigger now. They got OG Anunoby healthy. He got hurt in game 2 last year. That's in part why Indiana was able to make that switch. OG gets hurt in game 2, misses games 3-6. Now they have Mikal Bridges. They got Mitchell Robinson, who was out last year as well, missed all 3 matchups during this regular season. And so if Siakam is defending OG Anunoby, and if Haliburton is on Josh Hart, can Nembhard bother Bridges? And what if the Knicks go with 2 bigs in this series? If they go with a lot of Cat, a lot of Mitchell Robinson, does Turner stick to Cat, or does he defend Mitchell Robinson? And if he defends Mitchell Robinson, does Cat get defended by Siakam? And then who defends OG Anunoby? I feel like there's a big domino effect here, and it begins with Brunson, though. How do you contain him? Regardless of what the Knicks are doing with their lineup choices, Indiana needs to cut the head off of the snake here. How do you contain Jalen Brunson? And so far, last postseason, this season, it's been Aaron Nesmith's length and aggression that's been best equipped to at least make Brunson look human. Question number 2, will the Knicks create a size advantage in this series against the Pacers? Because on paper, the Cavs were supposed to do it. Jared Allen, Evan Mobley, but Allen forgot how to rebound. He played soft in the final 2 games for Cleveland. Evan Mobley had a pretty solid series overall, but he wasn't featured inside in the ways that I think a lot of Cavs fans probably wish he was. And obviously, you know, regardless of how those two performed, the Cavs shot like garbage from 3 in the series. So are the Knicks going to have better success with their 2 big lineups? Throughout this postseason, Karl-Anthony Towns and Mitchell Robinson have played 90 minutes together. They have a 113 offensive rating, a 98.2 defensive rating. That's plus 14.8 if you can't do the math. An offensive rebound percentage of 39.8%. Not quite Steven Adams, Alperen Şengün rebounding over half of Houston's misses, but 39.8% is pretty damn good. So I believe personally, and I've felt this way all year long, that the 2 bigs were going to be integral to New York's success. And I feel like I've been proven right for the Knicks so far in this postseason. They've played those guys a lot more often in the playoffs than they ever did during the regular season. And it's been great for the Knicks, as shown in the numbers. And I also believe in this series against the Pacers, they create bigger matchup issues. 1 big, it's pretty simple for Indiana. Turner, going to defend Karl-Anthony Towns. Siakam, going to defend OG Anunoby. Halliburton's going to hide on Josh Hart. And then it's going to be Nembhard or Nesmith on Bridges, Nembhard or Nesmith on Brunson. But with 2 bigs, where does Halliburton hide? Where are you going to put him? Does Siakam need to defend Mitchell Robinson or Karl-Anthony Towns because you got Turner defending one of those guys? Does this mean OG Anunoby has a potential advantage to create his own shot or attack closeouts and use his size to his advantage. We'll obviously see how this plays out, but Cat and Robinson played 40 minutes in round one versus Detroit, 50 minutes in round two versus Boston, and they dominated that matchup. I think those two are going to have to play even more against Indiana and really give the Knicks an advantage. And this relates to my next thought, my next question on this series, because we know what Brunson can do. 43 clutch points so far this postseason, leads the NBA by far in the playoffs. Jokic, I believe, is second with 26, and obviously he's done for the postseason now. Number three, can Cat have the series of his life? Towns dominated the Pacers this season, 21 points in October, 30 points in November, 40 points in February, no Miles Turner of that matchup. Thomas Bryant is playing a lot of heavy minutes. He started for Indiana. You can probably throw all three of those out. This season, though, when defended specifically by Miles Turner, Karl-Anthony Towns shot 13 of 22. He was 9 of 15 from two-point range. Those are great numbers, obviously. He was very good this season when he was defended by Miles Turner. But past seasons, during his time in Minnesota, he was only 19 of 53 overall and only 11 of 34 from two-point range. So Cat was great this year against the Miles Turner matchup, but not so good in the past. 11 of 34 from two-point range is not a good number. So Turner historically has done a great job on Karl-Anthony Towns, and this again brings it back to my two big point. If you can get Turner off of Cat, and in Indiana, if they feel like they have to put Turner on Robinson because Robinson might be creating offensive rebounds, second chance opportunities, tip outs, then Karl-Anthony Towns might have a major size advantage. He's 22 of 44 in post-ups so far this postseason, not shooting the ball as well from three, 34% from three this postseason, including only 16% last round against the Celtics. If you can get Cat inside with a size advantage, I think that's another thing that could give the Knicks an edge in the series. Number four, can Haliburton reach a new level? Brunson, like, we know what this dude's going to do. 25 shots, maybe even 30 shots some nights for the Knicks. Haliburton's going to take 10 to 15. Like, that's just the reality. He has one game this postseason taking over 20 shots, and it was an overtime closeout game against the Bucks. Is that number going to have to change? I love Haliburton. The dude is an awesome player. He is so fun to watch. Like, I've always loved passers. I love Steve Nash. In the 2000s, I always liked watching Chris Paul. I loved Rajon Rondo. These pass-first point guards are, like, just some of my favorite players. I've always liked pass-first point guards, and I still love Tyrese Haliburton with as he is. But Siakam is not a guy who creates a lot of offense this year for Indiana. Nembhard, we'll see how he performs in this series against some of these long-armed, lengthy Knicks defenders. This might have to be the series that number has to increase for Haliburton into Brunson range, at least on a handful of occasions in the series. Because, look, man, like I said, Siakam last year against the Knicks, he dominated Josh Hart. But why is he being defended by Josh Hart? Because OG Anunoby's out. You're going to see OG against Siakam this year. Siakam was 17 of 26 when defended by Hart last series last year, posting him up over and over, shot over the top. Use his size, overpower him on drives. The Pacers are gonna have OG on Siakam this year. We're going to see Indiana put bridges on Haliburton. That's a much tougher matchup than throughout this postseason when Halliburton's been defended by Gary Trent Jr. and Kevin Porter against the Bucks, Max Strus and Isaac Okoro against the Cavaliers. It's going to be tougher for Haliburton, but also I think they're going to need more from him. Again, only over 20 shots only once this entire postseason when he had 22 for 26 points in the closeout game against the Bucks. I think we're going to have to see more of that from Haliburton for Indiana to win the series. I initially felt Indiana had the edge in this series, but as I dove into it a bit deeper over the last 24 hours after my podcast I did with Dane Moore covering the Western Conference series, I'm now leaning towards the Knicks. I'll pick the Knicks in seven. I think this is a very close series. I think it's going to be an epic series, a fun series. For anybody who's not a Knicks or a Pacers fan, they're going to be stressed out. We're all going to be having fun. But I'm going to pick the Knicks in seven to go to the NBA Finals over the Pacers. With the Western Conference, I covered that entirely with Dane Moore on my Sunday pod. Go listen to that if you want to hear about the Wolves and the Thunder. But today, let's talk about some trade rumors, because a lot of the stuff that's been talked about in Chicago is not just about the draft. People are wondering what's going to happen with Giannis. Of course, he has a meeting this week with the Milwaukee Bucks about his future, about the state of the team. We'll probably talk about that later in the week once we hear some details about that. But the other thing a lot of people in Chicago at the Combine were wondering about is, what the hell are the Celtics going to do? They got their second apron penalties kicking in. Jason Tatum just ruptured his Achilles. He had surgery. He's out for most, if not all, of next season. The Celtics' 2032 first-round pick is frozen for now because of the second apron penalties, unless they can unfreeze it. Complicated rules. They can unfreeze their 2032 pick if they're not in the second apron in three of the next 4 years. So question five, what changes are the Celtics actually going to make? Their GM, Brad Stevens, spoke on Monday at a press conference. Didn't really say anything. I feel like I honestly wasted my time watching it. So good on Brad Stevens. Did his job. Didn't give the media anything at all. Kudos to him. For me, I wasted 30, 40 minutes of my life. And for him, one thing he did say is, like, we haven't had time to talk about what we're going to do this summer. Maybe that's true. Maybe they need more time to plan, because there's a lot of potential opportunities for them. We know they're going to have to trim salary. We know that's going to happen, but who? Jrue Holiday is going to be 35 years old. He has 3 years and $140 million remaining on his contract. He's the guy people talk about most, but 3 years, $104 million at 35 years old after an underwhelming season, shot only 35% from three in the regular season, only 34.6% from three in the playoffs. The list of teams I'd imagine for Jrue Holiday that have interest would be short, and any return for him probably wouldn't be too significant at all. So Jrue Holiday, yes, there's a chance you could see him moved, but the return I cannot imagine would be that great. Kristaps Porzingis, that's the guy every Celtics fan wants to see traded right now after he just completely was a dud in the postseason with this unknown illness. That makes his value super murky. He's not a $30.7 million expiring contract that can be a significant contributor. Clearly, he is a $30.7 million expiring contract, period. That's Porzingis' value right now for the Celtics. He is not a significant value guy right now until maybe this summer playing for Team Latvia. He proves that he's back healthy, but that's a long ways from now. Peyton Pritchard, $7.8 million. Has great value. I don't know why the Celtics would move him. Minor savings. I'd imagine if they were to move Pritchard, it'd be like some surprising, ridiculous, you guys are really offering that type of return. Same thing for Sam Hauser, $11.3 million. Solid role player. Great shooter. Not a lot of savings if they move him. Derek White, $32.6 million average annual value for him over the remaining 3 years of his contract. Logan Murdoch, my old teammate at the Ringer, said the Warriors might go for Derek White this offseason. That's the type of player they want to go for. That's intriguing to me, because the Warriors, in all likelihood, they're going to want to continue with this Jimmy Butler, Stephen Curry, Draymond Green core that they have going. Derek White would be a perfect fit for the Steve Kerr offense. Like, that's obvious. His shooting ability, the high IQ decision-making, the defense, like, Derek White would be just glorious for the Golden State Warriors. How desperate are they going to get, though? Because why would the Celtics trade Derek White, who's only going to be 31, still feels like he's getting better every year, even though he's over 30 at this point? The Warriors have the potential after the league year changes till next year. So July 1st, the Warriors will have the ability to trade their first rounders in 26, 28, and 32, plus swaps in 27, 29, and 31. So three first outright, they have three swaps as well. How desperate would they actually get for an offer for Derek White? How desperate would anybody get to go get Derek White from Boston? Because I don't see the Celtics moving White unless it's an over-the-top offer, and maybe the Warriors would be willing to make that. Maybe Logan does know something about their intentions there. All of this leads me to Jaylen Brown. Going to make $61 million average for the remainder of his contract. Has by far the highest value to the Celtics. Also by far the highest value to anybody else, because he's the best player, obviously. Here's my question. If a team misses out on Giannis, could they pivot to Jaylen Brown? And could that team be the Houston Rockets? Could you see Ime Udoka, the head coach of Houston, reunite with Jaylen Brown in Houston with some type of offer like Fred VanVleet, the number 10 pick this year, and some number of future first-round picks? VanVleet has a team option that can be declined if this deal were to happen before July 1st. VanVleet's option could be declined, and the Celtics could cleanly get under the second apron by declining that option. Would give them immense flexibility, tons of future draft capital. And without Jaylen Brown, you'd get to see what Derek White could do, what Peyton Pritchard could do with a ton more touches next season. You'd get to see what guys like Baylor Shireman and Jordan Walsh, these young guys on their rookie skill contracts, what can they offer? Can they give more with more minutes and more touches? There'd be less pressure to move off Jrue Holiday or Kristaps Porzingis for low returns. And obviously, Jaylen Brown is finals MVP. He has been awesome, you know, for Boston. He won a title, of course. He's been a great player, a great co-star next to Jason Tatum for years. But he's going to be 29 next season. He's going to make $53 million, and then $57 million, and then $61 million, and then $65 million. By the time he's in his mid-30s, this might be his peak value for a team that whiffs on Giannis and decides, let's go to somebody else. Let's try for somebody else. So that's where I'm coming from, where I look at the situation of Boston. If you're not going to get a lot for Jrue or Porzingis, and if you're not willing to trade Derek White, like, who has the most value? Who's going to get you the most back and still allow you to get Tatum back the following year and maybe be in a position to keep contending? With that said, Stevens did say one thing during his presser today. He said, fireworks on draft night with us, I don't think so. As far as moving up into those levels of the draft, he's talking about top 10 because they interviewed Cooper Flagg, as I reported last week. They interviewed Trey Johnson, a potential top 5-6 pick at the draft combine as well. He said, as far as moving up to those levels of the draft, I would guess that is probably not on the table. So, of course, Stevens is going to say, yeah, of course we'll entertain an offer from the Houston Rockets for Jaylen Brown. He said nothing during the presser, but I just wanted to point out that he doesn't expect fireworks, at least publicly. He doesn't expect fireworks. So we'll see about that with the Celtics. I do think the team that loses out on Giannis, whoever those teams are, could be all of them if Giannis stays in Milwaukee. I think you're going to see them make calls to Boston for Jaylen Brown, a finals MVP, a guy still in the prime of his career, and maybe could be even better next season. Maybe Boston takes a step back next year, learns a lot about the rest of their roster, and then has a higher draft pick because they do own their own 2026 draft pick. And who knows? Could get Brockton, Massachusetts' own A.J. DiBonsa. Who knows? Just saying. You never know. The Dallas Mavericks just moved up to number one with the 11th best odds. Maybe the Celtics win next year. So I think that's a possibility to think about if you're a Boston fan. Speaking of the draft, I also published a new mock draft on Yahoo Sports. I'm not going to go through the entire thing today, but I did want to go through some of the risers and the fallers in this mock draft after spending my whole last week in Chicago interviewing a bunch of these guys, talking and meeting with people around the league as well. So arguably the biggest combined loser, according to teams, is Derek Queen, freshman big man out of Maryland. I now have him going number 12 to the Bulls. And my mock draft, I previously had him number 8 to the Brooklyn Nets. Number 12 for Derek Queen. Look, man, undeniably has skill. I love Derek Queen. I think he's a very fun, entertaining player, but he was last in max vertical leap, last in standing vertical leap, last in lane agility, second to last in three quarters court sprint, second to last in the shuttle run. He didn't shoot well. He was one of the worst shooters there. He had a very noticeable like pause hitch type of look in his jumper. It did not look better than it did during the season at Maryland. If anything, it looked worse. He was moving slow through drills. He wasn't shooting at game speed. Like, there's a lot of criticisms of Queen, and I did an interview Queen as well. Like, I sat down with him for 30 minutes. We're going to air that probably later this week on the podcast. I think he's a really good kid, but he's definitely a kid. So he needs a lot of seasoning, a lot of time to mature both on and off the court, and I think that's why you're seeing teams talk about him as a guy who not going to move up into the top 5 or 6, more likely move to the back end of the lottery. And for him, that's okay. I think less pressure on him early in his career, falling into to ideal situation, that could actually be a good thing for his long term. But this week specifically, he did not show out, unfortunately. Number seven, who were the draft combine risers? I'll give you three of them. Carter Bryant out of Arizona. I have him going number 11 to the Blazers in my mock draft. Carter Bryant, I'm like very split on him. I think he's a very theoretical player, but he's almost 6'7", almost has a 7-foot wingspan. Teams were very impressed by his interviews, the maturity he showed as a freshman out of Arizona, the understanding of his game. Like, you know, a clip went viral on social media of him talking about how he watches a lot of Toumani Kamara. I'm sure his agent fed him that name to say because it gets all the draft nerds excited. Ooh, Kamara, he's hardcore and knows deep cut players. But like Carter Bryant, no doubt about his athleticism. Teams believe in his jumper. I'm still a little bit less high on him. He's 11 on my mock, but I have him, I think, 15 or 16 on my board. He's just a very theoretical guy to me. I'd probably have him higher. Like, if I'm the Blazers, I want to take a swing, and maybe this guy with his size and versatility turns into something special. But he undeniably is looking more and more like a lottery pick, not like a guy who's going to go back to Arizona since he's just testing the waters. Next up, Maxime Raynaud, number 23 to the Pacers. Actually, didn't change on my mock draft at all. I had him 23 last mock draft as well, but he proved a lot to really cement that status. And a lot of teams, I think other evaluators in the draft community, are now catching up to me, like in others that have had him in the top 20-ish range on our boards. But 23 to the Pacers in this mock, shot the hell out of it in the scrimmage, off-ball movement actions. This dude is not just a 7-footer who stands up and shoots catch-and-shoot threes. Raynaud is a guy with skill off the dribble, skill with movement. He moves like a wing. Teams wanted to see him defend, though, and he looked good in the scrimmage, protecting the rim, rotated well. He was very communicative throughout the scrimmage as well, barking out calls as the low man. It was impressive to see him do a lot of that in this setting with a bunch of new teammates. So for teams that had questions about Raynaud's defense, I think he answered a lot of those questions and now looks firmly as a first round pick. I still think he belongs top 15 or so. We'll see if he gets up to that point through pre-draft workouts, because I have a hard time believing a guy 7 feet tall with the shot that he has and the potential he has on defense would fall outside the top 20. But for now, number 23 to the Pacers in my mock draft. The biggest riser, I interviewed him last week. You saw it on the podcast. Cedric Coward from Washington State. Currently have him going number 17 to the Minnesota Timberwolves in my mock draft. Maybe that'll be too low. Maybe it's about right. We'll see in the coming weeks ahead of the draft itself in late June. But he measured in 6'5" without shoes, with a 7'2" wingspan. He was one of the best shooters in every drill, one of the best athletes across the board in everything they measured, speed drills, leaping drills, everything. He was near the top. And if you listen to my interview with him, this is really the number one reason why teams are hype about him. You know, if you listen to that interview with him, he's one of the best people in the draft. He's amazing, self-aware, mature. I had a team tell me he's the most mature individual they've interviewed at the combine in many years. So look, man, Cedric Coward, we'll see how the next few weeks go for him throughout pre-draft workouts. But Coward, Raynaud, and Bryant seem to be three of the biggest risers in mocks right now after their weeks at the draft combine. And speaking of mature players, I have an interview with Con Knipple that's out on my podcast that's coming up right now. Here with Con Knipple, projected top 10 pick in the 2025 NBA drafts. Con, how you doing today, man?
Doing all right. Living the dream.
Appreciate you joining me today. You are indeed living the dream here in Chicago at the draft combine. For somebody who doesn't know you, your game, how would you describe your game to somebody who's never watched Con Knipple play?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously like the shooting is probably mentioned first. But I try to do a bit of everything, a little bit on ball, in some ball screen situations. But I'm really just going to fly around the court and give it my all out there, try to get to every loose ball and then try to hold my own on defense.
I mean, I feel like it's true. Like, obviously the shooting is your number one trait. the ball handling. You had that game in the tournament. Cooper goes out. You ran, I think, like a season high 8 or 9 pick and rolls with Malawach in that game, and you're creating for him. You're scoring yourself. You're throwing lobs. You're kicking it out. Your pick and roll game, I think, is probably one of the most underrated assets, you know, when it comes to people that just talk about you as a shooter. How would you assess your progress, you know, since high school over your year at Duke as a shot creator?
Yeah, I mean, especially in the ball screens, like I didn't run those very much in high school, even as the point guard my senior year. So I wasn't super familiar with all that. But once we started doing it at Duke, you know, Kaman's a big target, kind of came natural with him. If you're on defense and like there's a guard trying to play the low man, like you're there, but you're not really in position to stop Kaman from catching it. So trying to get it to him as much as I could on those roles. But also, you know, I'm used to playing with the ball in my hand a ton, and I was glad that I got put in some of those opportunities at Duke.
How much of that improvement was through film study or on-court stuff with, you know, the coaching staff? Like, how would you describe how that improvement occurred?
A lot of it was with the staff. Mm-hmm. One of our assistants, Coach Dildy, would watch film with me like almost every day before and after practice, and we were on the court working on that stuff every day. If it wasn't like ball screen stuff, it was individual stuff, working on skills, mid-range shooting, stuff like that.
Earlier today, Cooper Flagg had his media roundtable thing, and he said, "Con is just a great all-around person, player, very well-rounded. Anywhere he goes, he's going to be great. He's just so solid in many different ways. He's such a safe pick. There's not really a lot of downside to taking Con." What's your reaction to what Cooper Flagg said?
That's pretty cool, you know, especially coming from a great player like him. He's a real good dude, great teammate. I'd say the same thing, probably a little bit more about him. You know, he's got unlimited potential, but he's a better person than he is a player, which is saying a lot because he's a really, really good player.
He's an awesome player. And, I mean, both of you, I mean, the team was incredible in general, which is why it was kind of shocking the way the year ended. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure for you, like, obviously you wish the year ended, but was there anything learned in the loss? Do you feel like there's, you know, sometimes when you hit lows in life, you learn something from that? Like, is there anything good that you're taking from the way that season ended?
Absolutely. Like you mentioned, there's lows in life. So it's just a basketball game at the end of the day, but really it's something that you put a lot of time in for a whole year with a bunch of good people. And it was kind of like a job, and it's like something going wrong at your job. And so how do you respond to that? And that's kind of what I've been doing, this off season, just getting better, kind of using that as fuel a little bit. Cause it leaves a bad taste in your mouth on your career that way.
What kind of things have you been working on in response to that?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of individual stuff, obviously, a lot of ball screen stuff, like we just talked about, working on my conditioning, getting the best shape I can be. And then just off the bounce, shooting. Creation, being able to create a little more separation. I think that's something I need to get better at, and then creativity around the rim.
I mean, you mentioned off the dribble creation. I have some stats there. You shot 43% off the catch from three this season, according to Synergy. Mid-range, you shot 16 of 37, 43% on pull-up jumpers. From three on pull-ups, only 3 of 21, 14%. Yeah. What is the key to extending your range from mid-range to three-point range off the dribble? What are you working on to improve that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to get more comfortable. You know, it's not a shot, like 21 shots in a whole season.
Small sample.
40 games, small sample size. Yeah. Like, I wasn't really comfortable shooting those, to be completely honest. Like, I didn't shoot a ton of them in high school. So I've just got to get reps, got to get better at it, get more comfortable, and I'll get better from there. The mid-range, too. I mean, we didn't shoot a lot of mid-range at Duke. I want that to be more of a staple in my game, because I think that's a great shot for me.
Don't take a lot of floaters either. Like, was that more of a Duke thing, just not like not taking floaters, going more to the rim?
Yeah, we didn't take a lot of non-rim twos, a lot of threes. We wanted in-out threes and layups. But when you're on a great team, like, you're always working to get a great shot, and I think working more on that individual stuff will be good, and I'll be more efficient at those going forward.
With your at rim finishing, you shot 62% at the rim in the half court per Synergy, and you know, with you, you're like 2 foot finishing a lot. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the value of 2 foot finishing for you at the rim?
Yeah, I think it's more valuable in college than it is in the pros. There's less space, more guys in the lane. Obviously, the rules, the size of the lane is different. in the pros. So that's what kind of why I've been working more on one-foot finishing creativity here this offseason. More those floater-type mm-hmm. shots, mid-range shots. But, two-feet finishing is really effective in college basketball, utilizing your shot fake, your pivots, something I really try to do this season.
I mean, ultimately, like, there are certain guys like Brunson, obviously, yeah. are much larger than Brunson, yeah. but he still uses two-foot finishing as what, a 6'1", 6'2 guard
yeah.
in the NBA, but he's also got the floater. He's also got the fadeaway.
Right.
He's got absolutely. Everything in yeah. the NBA, right?
Absolutely.
So it's about expanding your package.
Yeah.
That's what you're trying yep. to do right now. Yep. I see. And what players would you compare yourself most to?
I try not to compare myself to anybody. I take a lot. I try to watch a lot of different players and take stuff from them. Like I always say, Clay. Like I love how Clay played, and I would love to play mm-hmm. like Clay. You know, just he's so efficient with his movement. He's shooting the ball the same, even if his feet aren't facing the right way. His shoulders are, and just the way he used to defend when he was younger before the injuries. And then Jimmy Butler, I say a lot too. Like I just love how. Like his patient, he's a really good 2-foot finisher as well. He uses his shot fakes in the lane. Those are guys I always watched.
I see. So I'm curious, like with yourself, like if you could download a specific move from a player and install it into your game immediately overnight, you suddenly have the move perfected. What would that move be?
I mean, you mentioned Brunson. Like I just his like hip swivel. He just does the hip swivel post. All the time, and you know, like he gets into that fade, he gets into the fake fade up and under. Probably that one because that one's sick.
Okay, it's awesome. I mean, yeah. now you get the Knicks potentially in the conference finals in all yeah. likelihood. I mean, yeah. sadly for Boston, yeah. they Tatum out. But Knicks Pacers, it's looking like how much of the yeah. playoffs have you watched this year?
Quite a bit. Try to watch every game. Those second games are late sometimes. I get tired, so I go to sleep sometimes. But I've been trying to catch as many as I can. I went to two Bucks. Pacers playoff games in person in Milwaukee, so that was cool to see it live.
Did you grow up a Bucks fan?
I did, yeah.
I see. And obviously now you're not going to be a fan of anybody. Right.
Yep.
Who were some of your favorite Bucks players growing up when you were a younger kid?
My dad loves Michael Redd.
Oh, yeah?
Because Michael Redd was always the only good thing we had going. But Chris Middleton was a staple growing up, and then obviously Giannis. Giannis
of
is...
Course.
All Milwaukee and we love him, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I know, right? I know. We will see exactly. I'm sure your family, there's going to be Bucks fans there. No, they don't want him to trade yeah. be traded, but we'll see. We'll see what happens with the Bucks. Maybe they can pull off some surprising moves, or maybe Giannis decides to stay. Who really knows?
Who knows?
We'll see about that. How would you describe yourself in three words as a person?
As a person, man. Three words. I'd say humble. Humility is big for me. I'd say chill. Chill. Like I'm not trying to go out and do a bunch of stuff when I have free time. I want to relax. And then I'd say grateful. I feel like I have a pretty good perspective about all the cool stuff I get to do. And so I just cherish all the stuff I get to do, even if it's a little hectic like this week at the combine or whatever else is going on.
What's your biggest motivator for success?
I think so. I was raised in a Christian family, and I think that's faith is really important to us. So I think my biggest motivator is I feel like it was my gift to play hoops, and I guess now to do it at the highest level. So just letting my light shine and shine through that and do the best I can do because it's the gift I've been given. So I think that's the big motivator for me.
It's like putting your all into it to fulfill whatever it is that you will be in life, right?
Absolutely.
And I mean, I feel like you're definitely on that path right now. You're here in Chicago. You're definitely, top 10 pick. You know, maybe, who knows, could be top 5 pick. We'll see how things continue to go. And like, you've had an amazing career so far. What has been the most memorable moment for you so far in your basketball playing career?
I'd say senior year, we went undefeated, won the state championship in Wisconsin. That was big time.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Doing it with my brother, my cousin, and all my friends, and then doing it in front of the whole school in the Kohl Center in Madison. Mm-hmm. That was big time. I mean, then making a Final Four is pretty special too. Beating Alabama and that game in Newark. was a real special feeling, considering they lost in the Elite Eight. Duke lost in the Elite Eight last year. So being able to come through and rewrite that wrong.
What do you remember as your first encounter with basketball?
Man, both my parents played, so they loved hoops.
It's probably baby pictures of you with a ball in your hands,
yeah,
right?
Probably, yeah. The first thing I remember, though, is kind of we got mini hoops, like full court mini hoops in our playroom. Like you play back and forth, but playing on those by myself.
That's pretty good. I mean, like, so you have a basketball family then. Really, yeah. Everybody plays the game. Everybody loves the game. That must be pretty awesome, right?
Yeah, it's pretty sick. It's really important to us. Kind of something that all brings us together. Even my extended family is a bunch of hoopers as well. So it's pretty sweet. Those holidays and those things, a lot of pickup games, those get competitive.
Do you have a group chat with friends or family or even multiple chats where you guys are talking about the playoff games and whatnot?
Not playoff games. Unfortunately, some of my family doesn't have the ball knowledge that I do.
Mm-hmm.
I would say so. My mom is not particularly keeping up with the NBA, nor my father. But yeah, definitely in some other group chats with buddies.
They're keeping up with the Kniffles.
Yes. trying to make sure the family stays all right.
It's like keeping up with the Kardashians, keeping up with the Kniffles. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe I have a reality TV show.
Hopefully not.
I can't imagine it, but you never know. Maybe you'll end up with the Lakers someday in the future and it'll happen. But, LA. But, you know, it is kind of cool you guys have that together. And I mean, you say don't text with them in the group chat about ball necessarily, but what have you thought about these playoffs so far? Because it feels like, to me, most physical playoffs I've seen ever, really.
Yeah, no, it's great. The physicality is awesome. It's crazy how different it is in the regular season. Like I remember watching a game, it was like the Cavs and the Nuggets. I'm like, this is two really, really good basketball teams, obviously. And it's just not as physical, not as intense. But now, man, it's such good television. It's so good to watch. All these guys are playing so hard. I think about like Josh Hart, like he's just flying all over the court. Their series have been fun to watch. It's been a blast.
Yeah, I know. I think like the NBA can't let it be 82 games of this.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it can't be.
But man, like it's just on another level. I'm having more fun watching basketball. I love basketball. Yeah. But like it just makes the regular season feel more like, yeah, this is fun, this is for entertainment, but like these are like wars on the court between these teams right now. It's just on another level.
And the best thing about the playoffs too, it's every night.
Mm-hmm.
It's every night for however many nights. Yeah, it's great.
It's crazy. It's from really mid-April, really early April with like some of the close games at the end of the season, then the play-in, but like it's what, 3 months of just nonstop action. Some random questions for you.
Okay.
If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Probably flight. I think flight's just, that'd be sweet.
I mean, we're in the 30th floor.
Yeah, just jump out here and soar out. Yeah, definitely that.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah.
Some people have said teleportation or invisibility, I mean, but you want to just the feeling of flying.
Yeah, I don't think flying is like the most overpowered ability, but it would be the coolest.
I think it would be pretty. Could you like take off like Superman style from the ground? Yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
That'd be sweet.
What's your weirdest habit?
I set like too many alarms. So whenever I got something going on, I set an alarm, and I don't really label them too often either. So I kind of forget what they're supposed to be.
What was this one for? Interview?
Yeah, like this whole week, I've just been setting alarms. it's probably just should have a better memory about when I got to do stuff, safe.
I think in the iPhone, they need the label within the clock alarm system. Like, I think you can set the alarm in there, but there's no label, right?
You can label it. Yeah,
okay, you can label in there.
Yeah.
Does your alarm ever go quiet? Because I've had my alarms go off and it doesn't make noise.
Yeah, sometimes it just does the little buzz. The
vibration, but I don't get my noise.
That happens. That is annoying.
Very annoying. That I don't know how that happens, but it does. Is there any music you listen to that would surprise some people?
I don't know if it would surprise anybody, but like my parents are big into like 80s soft rock. That's where they come from. Oh, yeah. So I listen to a bunch of that.
Okay.
Or some like 90s grunge and that stuff's good. But I mean, I'm a big country music guy.
Okay.
I don't know if any of that would surprise anybody.
Any favorite country artists?
Morgan Wallen.
Okay.
Yeah, he's coming out a new album here in a couple days.
Oh, yeah? Well, you must be fired up for that. You're excited. Listening to it here in Chicago in your hotel.
Too many songs though. 36. It's gonna be. It's gonna be
36 songs.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It's gonna be great.
Has he released like 7 singles already, and still like the whole album is still not released?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes artists release too many singles. I want to be surprised.
Yeah, right.
You know, with the whole album. I'm an album guy, not a singles guy, personally.
Yeah, I agree.
You're an album guy as well. How about bands like that are album bands, like a Pink Floyd, where it's like listen from start to finish? You into them at all? Anybody like that?
Not really. No.
Okay. Well, that would have surprised me if you said that. Would have made me very happy. I would have raised you on my big board a couple spots if you said you like Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd.
But now I can't do that, unfortunately.
That's all right.
Let's say you're on the court, you're down 2 points, and your team needs a bucket. There's 7 seconds on the clock. Who are your 4 teammates you're drafting, past or present?
All time.
All time. And you guys need a bucket. Down 2, 7 seconds remaining.
Jordan. Larry Bird. Durant. And Kareem. Little skyhook.
I'd be surprised if you guys aren't scoring.
Yeah, I think we're gonna score. I'm gonna sit in the corner.
You're a floor spacer right there, right?
Maybe a little Jordan drives and a little Steve Kerr.
I mean, he passes it out to Kerr sometimes, right? You never know. That could work. What do you do besides basketball? What are your interests? You said chilling earlier. What does chilling mean?
Yeah, I mean, just hanging with my family, doing whatever. Like, if we have time together as a family, which is not very often. Because we're all running around practice and tournaments and stuff. But definitely like watching a movie together as a family is one of my favorite pastimes. Going up north to Door County in Wisconsin is a great time. We're on the beach right on Lake Michigan. It's great. Or just like hanging with my buddies playing cards. A little poker maybe. Or we go into like a little mini golf. For whatever reason, we're into miniature golf.
I don't play mini golf in a minute. It's fun.
It's so fun. but yeah, I mean, I'm pretty simple. I don't have a whole lot. Whenever I have some free time, I just want to spend it with the people I love to be around.
What do you love most about the game of basketball?
Man, I just love to compete. I think first and foremost, like, I just love getting out there. And even when I was young, trying to test myself and always wanting to win. I think that's something it's really drawn me to basketball, but also I love like just getting in the gym and by yourself, like that feeling, getting shots up or I'm getting better. I'm going game speed, working on my game. I love that process which not a lot of people have. And I don't know. I just really, really enjoy that part of basketball as well.
Con, I have a feeling in 10 or 15 years, you're still going to be thriving in the NBA. You just got one of those types of games, man. It's like Cooper said with that quote, he's just solid. Solid in so many different ways, man. And I'm excited to watch you develop in the NBA, and I really appreciate you joining me on today's show, man.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Big thanks to Con Knipple for joining me on today's episode. We'll be back again later in the week talking about the NBA playoffs, NBA draft, NBA trade rumors, everything that's going on. Thanks to everybody who produced this episode, and thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back. Have a good week.